Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Hong Kong's six-month-old protest movement has been one of the biggest international stories of 2019. Now, what began in June as a protest against a bill that would allow for the extradition of criminal suspects to mainland China has turned into a full-blown democracy campaign. And it's not over yet. On December 8th, an estimated 800,000 people marched through the city's commercial center. This march was peaceful, but of course many of the demonstrations have not been. Police have arrested over 6,000 people and fired 10,000 canisters of tear gas since the protests began. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at the situation in Hong Kong in light of some recent developments, a sweep by pro-democracy candidates in local elections in late November, and the passage of a U.S. law aimed at protecting human rights in the city. We'll also talk about the challenges for journalists who have been covering months of violence on the streets. To kick things off, we're going to bring in Stephen Russolillo. He's a Hong Kong correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Stephen, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Obviously, these protests have disrupted Hong Kong's economy. Talk to us about how that's visible.
Yeah, you basically can't really avoid it at all. And so I think that the biggest impact to the economy really has been anything that's consumer facing. So if we think about tourism, you think about hotels, restaurants, everything like that has been hit very, very hard. Just a couple months ago, a data came out showing that Hong Kong is now in a recession. It's the first recession since the global financial crisis over a decade ago. And a lot of economists think that worse is yet to come. There's other data that shows retail sales, which is sort of an indicator of just consumption in the economy, that had its worst drop in October on record. It's just, you basically can't really avoid it. Wherever you walk around the city, you see it. I mean, there's empty storefronts. If small businesses are still there, I mean, they're struggling to pay their rent. It's really had a wide-ranging effect.
And you wrote a story about Disneyland Hong Kong and the effect on the theme park.
Yeah, I mean, Disney is completely empty. Now, there's a couple of caveats here. The Disneyland in Hong Kong is one of the least popular parks that Disney has around the world. But even with that said, though, a colleague and I went to the theme park on a weekday a few weeks ago, and it was just totally empty. I mean, you could go on any ride you wanted and didn't have to wait on any lines. You could eat at any restaurant. If they were open, you could eat at any restaurant there. It was really kind of a spooky thing. And talking to some people there, people found it to be strange. I mean, one couple I talked to was talking about how they're like, you know, it's weird to be in Disney. We feel weird having fun knowing that there are other people that are out on the streets fighting for democracy. And I thought that quote really captured the essence really well, especially what Disney is going through, because, you know, Disney is the happiest place on earth, obviously. And so, but yet just a few miles away in other parts of the city, you know, you have people that are really fighting for stuff that they truly, truly believe in and have been fighting for so long now for this. It's the Disney thing is just one sort of indicator of just the economy overall and what's happening.
Yeah. And obviously when there are scenes of police firing dozens of canisters of tear gas at protesters, you would think that that would depress tourism. But obviously this is hitting people in their own pocketbooks and affecting their own family's income. So do you see that this is affecting people's support for these protests, for this democracy movement?
You know, counterintuitively, it's not. And if anything, I think the movement is actually as strong as it's been over the past 6 months. You mentioned at the top of your show that just a week ago, there was a big peaceful protest that had 800,000 people show up. I mean, that's as good a sign as any that this movement is still very strong, even as the economy around it is not doing very well. And to me, I actually find that quite striking, because normally, if you think about, you know, a small business owner, you know, let's say someone who owns a restaurant, okay, and I've talked to a few restaurant owners here who say that their sales are down anywhere from a third to 60 or 70% from before the protests. I mean, that is a big material impact. It could prompt some of them to close in the future. And yet a lot of these people still were very supportive of the protests. And because they know that what the protesters are fighting for is bigger than, you know, a downturn in the economy or even a downturn that they might feel in their own pockets. And so I found that really, really fascinating, actually, and really interesting. The question that I have now is, you know, if this movement continues and if the, well, let's phrase it this way, if the hit to the economy continues for much longer, will that support remain? And I guess we'll have to wait and see on that one.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you raise some of these underlying factors that have sort of spread support for this movement. One of those that I've seen mentioned frequently is inequality and rising inequality in Hong Kong. Talk to us about that. How do you see that on the street just as you move around the city? How is that a factor in this?
I mean, Hong Kong arguably has some of the worst income inequality in the world. On the one hand, this is a global financial center. It's obviously a gateway to mainland China, and that is appealing to a lot of big multinational corporations. A lot of banks have their Asian headquarters here. And so you see that on the one end of the spectrum, there's a lot of wealthy bankers and hedge fund managers and so forth. And you know, that's one side of it. And then on the other side, you have some people that are literally living in what are called cage homes. They are cages that people, they are what they sound like, that people are living in and paying because that's all they can afford. And so you have these two really polar opposite ends of the spectrum. And I would say that this is part of the problem in the sense that the government is not doing enough to alleviate the income inequality. And it may be one of the reasons that is propelling people to take to the streets and protest for what they believe in.
Well, you spoke about Hong Kong's status as a business center. And since the handover from the United Kingdom to China in 1997, there's been this sort of one country, two systems policy. And sort of the key underpinning of that was that Hong Kong would have its own independent judiciary system. And now, given that we've seen all these images of police beating people in the streets and all sorts of lawless activity, how is that system, how is it holding up?
Yeah, so this is one of the key issues here. And there's a lot of concern that China is encroaching on the one country, two systems framework that was initially put in place at the 1997 handover, as you mentioned. At that handover, in the agreement, it was said that Hong Kong would have 50 years of being in this sort of semi-autonomous region within China. And so it would have its own rule of law, it would maintain its government, and this would stay in place until 2047. Now, of course, we're approaching 2020 now. And so theoretically, there should still be 27 years left of that framework in place. But we've seen that China slowly but surely has been encroaching on that framework. And so that has had an impact, and that has made a lot of people angry. And so within these pro-democracy demonstrations and protests, it's a lot of anti-China sentiment that is really playing out on the streets.
Well, Stephen, our time grows short, but you wrote, you know, back in August, I think it was, about some of the tensions between Hong Kong's larger companies and the employees that work for them, in that the companies were sort of caught in a vice, if you will, because China didn't want them to show support for the protesters. And yet many of these same companies, airlines, other businesses, their employees were strongly in favor of the democracy movement. What's the status of that now? Do companies still find themselves in the same difficult spot?
It's a really tricky spot if you're a multinational company, because on the one hand, you want to allow your employees to express themselves. But on the other hand, you don't want to allow them to express themselves too much in the sense that it's going to hurt any business ties or business relations that you have with mainland China. We've seen this countless times throughout the years. And you know, one of the most recent examples, of course, is the NBA in China and everything after Daryl Morey's tweet about the Hong Kong protests. And so
is the Houston Rockets general manager.
Exactly. And so it's a very difficult spot, and it's a tricky spot. And I don't know that there's really one true blueprint or one right way for companies to kind of maneuver this or go about this. But I think at least what's happened is that, you know, companies don't want to clamp down on their employees because that creates bad morale. But at the other end, though, you don't want employees kind of being on the front lines and you know, having a PricewaterhouseCoopers logo on the frontline protester. I mean, that does not look good either. And so I don't mean to put PwC on the spot. I'm just using it as an example.
Sure.
It's very difficult.
Well, Stephen Russolillo, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about Hong Kong's protest movement, as well as the threats to the myriad journalists who've been covering it. Now, over the past 6 months, journalists have been hit by tear gas, projectiles, and pepper spray by the police, and reporters from pro-Beijing news outlets have been attacked by pro-democracy protesters. So to expand our discussion now, we're going to bring in two other guests in Hong Kong. Joining us now is Bing Guan. He's a photojournalist whose work has been published by many outlets, including Time and the Sunday Times magazine. He's been covering the protest movement there for months. Bing, welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
Also with us is Jennifer Creary. She's a deputy editor for the news site Hong Kong Free Press. Jennifer, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, let me start with you, Bing Guan. We mentioned there was this huge march just 4 or 5 days ago on Sunday in Hong Kong. Tell us about the mood and sort of the significance of that.
You know, it was my first time seeing such a large march. I wasn't here in June and July when the Civil Human Rights Front, which is a local organization that was, you know, organizing these massive 1-2 million person marches. And to see that for firsthand was really quite remarkable. I mean, people were jubilant. You know, they were. It was the first big march after the recent district council elections, and so, you know, people are singing songs, they're chanting slogans. I mean, the streets were just completely filled. You could not get through. But you know, it was very orderly. You know, there were even, you know, recycling checkpoints that have been set up by volunteers. You know, people wearing masks of cartoon mascots. And what was sort of striking was, you know, again, what's really remarkable about the Hong Kong protests is that it's encompassing such a broad segment of society, such broad segments of society. So everyone from the very young to the very old, people are bringing their kids to the protests. You know, you'll see elderly people walking with canes, or, you know, people in wheelchairs rolling through as, you know, a bunch of black clad teenagers are busy smashing up a Bank of China or leaving some graffiti.
Well, Jennifer Curry, let me bring you in as well, because it does seem like that this huge march that just took place was an indication that this movement isn't over yet.
Right. So the Civil Human Rights Front march was one of the first authorized marches to be held in Hong Kong for a while. The police have been consistently banning these large scale marches. Of course, the Civil Human Rights Front organized that 2 million strong march earlier a few months ago. And so it's very much seen as an indicator of the breadth of public support for the pro-democracy movement and for the protesters. While, of course, the public may disagree on the tactics with which they kind of, you know, pursue these kind of ideals. Certainly the turnout has been interpreted as a wide kind of sense of support for the pro-democracy movement.
Sure, because we're talking about a city of, what, 7 million people. And so if there's 800,000 people that come out, that's more than 10% of the people just marching in the streets. But Bing Guan, if I could turn this back to you. This march was peaceful, but there has been a lot of violence on a number of occasions over the past several months. You yourself have witnessed this. And in particular, it sounds like there have been a number of instances where Hong Kong police targeted journalists. What have you seen?
I've pretty much lost count of the number of times I've been tear gassed at this point. I've been pepper sprayed directly or indirectly probably 5 or 6 times, shoved a few. I've seen outside of Polyu, where, you know, the protesters had to held out for a 12-day police siege.
Oh, this is Hong Kong Polytechnic, you know, University, the siege there. It was a month and a half ago, I think, where there was the students were surrounded by police, basically.
Yes. And, you know, there was an escape attempt by several hundred students, and the police very violently cracked down on them. A lot of them weren't wearing protective equipment. But, you know, even there, I saw police firing pepper balls, you know, paintballs that were loaded with projectiles that of the same substance as pepper spray, you know, at a reporter's feet, just sort of, you know, shooing him away, even though, you know, you could have also just politely requested that the reporter move.
Well, Jennifer Creer, your news outlet has been covering these protests from the start. What issues have some of the folks at Hong Kong Free Press faced?
Right, so it's interesting to look at the police and protester response to reporters since the beginning of the movement. It began in June, and initially there was some pushback from protesters about photographers and journalists revealing protesters' faces in their live streams or in their images. But now there's been kind of a slow acceptance of that, and many protesters will wear masks, as do police. But now the kind of response that we're seeing for journalists, tactics have escalated. We've seen pushback against journalists, particularly when police are conducting clearance operations. So they will typically form a cordon around, for example, arrested protesters, and they will push journalists back. And this could be through various tactics, including pepper spray, tear gas, etc. And there have been various instances of journalists being hospitalized. And of course, one of the local journalists for a local media outlet called Stan News has recently been diagnosed with chloracne, which has been associated with dioxin, which is a key chemical kind of a compound of tear gas. So there's been kind of concern about the involvement of journalists in these protests and on the front lines, and we're not sure how this is going to pan out.
And there was also, correct me if I'm wrong, Jennifer, there was also an Indonesian journalist whose eye was shot out by a police projectile as well.
Yes, that's correct. So an Indonesian journalist was reporting from a footbridge, and her eye was struck with a projectile, and she subsequently lost sight in that eye. And that's kind of been widely interpreted as an encroachment on, you know, freedom of the press. But this is, of course, indicative of, you know, many of the kind of dangerous situations that people are put in at these protests, including protesters. There have been instances of protesters being struck with projectiles in their eye and their eyesight subsequently being affected. So it's certainly this climate is, you know, dangerous. There are escalating tensions, escalating tactics. And it's, like I said, we're not really sure how it's going to pan out.
Well, Bingguan, I wanted to ask you, when you spoke with our producer, you were particularly critical of the Hong Kong police force, like some of the training that they had. You just didn't feel like they were at all ready to handle mass protests.
No, I've spoken with a number of ex-police who are who have since left the force, who left the force quite a year ago. And one gentleman in particular I spoke with, who was former Royal Hong Kong Police, meaning he was here pre-takeover, really spoke that, you know, the level of standard for the training, particularly with the use of tear gas projectiles, was much higher. They weren't permitted to fire at the head. They had to fire, you know, over somebody's head or at their feet. They're never to fire tear gas projectiles directly at, you know, at somebody that they're trying to bring under control. And we've seen the Hong Kong police are no longer adhering to any of those guidelines. I mean, there have been emergency doctors have reported numerous protesters who are sort of a rash of injuries, particularly to the head and to the groin. So it seems that the police are deliberately targeting protesters as well as others with tear gas projectiles.
And Jennifer Curry, at the top of the show, I raised a couple sort of recent developments. One, as you mentioned, were these district council elections that happened just a couple weeks ago. And then also the passage of this human rights bill in the United States. Has that changed the dynamic at all in Hong Kong?
Yes and no. So the district council elections are kind of interpreted as indicative of the public support for the pro-democracy movement, as I was saying earlier, and the fact that the public can mobilize en masse to express this through these kind of, you know, democratic means, if you will. As for the passing of the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, that received kind of wide support from the public prior to the passing of the act, Hong Kongers had held several rallies urging the US to do so, and subsequently the bill received, you know, wide bipartisan support over in the US. But since its passing, you know, protesters have held at least two rallies to kind of express their thanks towards Washington. But of course, you know, no one has really been sanctioned fully yet. So we're not sure how that's going to be implemented. But the Hong Kong government has, you know, pushed back in its usual fashion by kind of condemning any such acts as an encroachment on it in its domestic affairs. So we're not sure if this is going to, you know, affect any of the dynamics within the government. But protesters are certainly hoping to mobilize kind of international support and foreign governments to kind of, you know, push back against the Hong Kong government and to support the protesters through these kind of means.
A reminder that you're tuned in to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about the democracy movement in Hong Kong and the challenges for the journalists who've been covering it over the last 6 months. We're joined now by the photojournalist Bing Guan and Jennifer Creary of the Hong Kong Free Press. And Bing Guan, if I could turn this back to you, within Hong Kong itself, I want to ask you, like, how is the media covering this? I mean, here in the U.S., everyone, of course, is focused on the impeachment proceedings against President Trump. But whether you're watching Fox News or you're watching CNN, you're hearing two very different narratives. Is it the same way in Hong Kong when it comes to the protests?
Certainly can be. There are certain publications and news outlets that are considered to be, very blue ribbon is the term. So very supportive of the establishment, supportive of the police. TVB, which is one of the major television broadcasters, often derisively nicknamed by supporters of the movement as CCTVB, in reference to Chinese state television, while other local news outlets like Stan News, which Jennifer mentioned earlier, are a bit more neutral or even occasionally a little bit leaning, somewhat more supportive of the protesters.
Well, Jennifer, let me ask you this, because you were born in Hong Kong. Many of the protesters are young people like yourself. If you were President Xi Jinping in China and you're looking at what's happened in Hong Kong over the last 6 months, would you be optimistic that this independence genie can be put back in the bottle and that this uprising will just peter out over time? Or is this a hallmark that there will be some more significant changes?
China has remained kind of characteristically tight-lipped about the movement, and many of the indicators of how Beijing is feeling have been expressed through state media, and you have to read that with somewhat of a pinch of salt. But it's worth remembering that Reuters published a leaked recording of Carrie Lam, that's Hong Kong's leader, chief executive, speaking in a closed-door meeting about how she had very little leeway. But she did kind of express that Beijing was willing to, quote, play it long. And that's been, typical of Beijing's kind of strategy with Hong Kong, to kind of wait for the movement to sort of peter out. And if, the movement has entered its seventh month now, and there's been kind of a relative lull in clashes, especially since the siege of Polyu, which Bing mentioned previously. But that doesn't mean that the protests have lost momentum. So, we're unsure how Beijing is going to react. There was rumors previously of, the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, coming to Hong Kong and, taking military action. But we haven't seen that yet. And, many critics have said that that, wouldn't bode well for both Beijing and Hong Kong economically. So we're not sure how China is going to react. But if that leaked recording is anything to go by, they are willing to play it long and wait.
No, as an outsider watching the news, there were some very tense moments in August, September, especially when there were reports of the Chinese military more massing near the border of Hong Kong. And it seemed possible that they might come in and just try to violently suppress these protests. But you mentioned this strategy of just trying to wait this out. I mean, there were big protests in Hong Kong 5 years ago. Many of our audience will remember the umbrella movement there. And the Chinese government, the Hong Kong government, they seem to effectively have waited that one out.
Right, but it's worth remembering what happened with the umbrella movement, which is the pro-democracy movement that you're referring to back in 2014. That was a static protest that was quashed within a number of days. So this, in comparison, this movement is a lot more violent. Bearing in mind, in 2014, when tear gas was used, it was a very big deal. Now over 16,000 canisters of tear gas have been deployed, according to the latest statistics released by the government. So this is on a different level. And there have been kind of criticisms of the Hong Kong police domestically and abroad over whether or not the force is able to handle these protests. It seems like protesters and police are locked in this kind of cat and mouse game whereby, flashpoints erupt and then they're quashed by, a clearance operation from the police, and then they kind of reoccur again and it descends into a cycle of violence. And so there have been questions raised domestically and internationally over whether or not Hong Kong is able to handle these protests.
Well, Bing Guan, I wanted to ask you about the issue of surveillance in Hong Kong as well. I do get the sense that's one of the that has been one of the issues for protesters earlier on, the police were shooting blue paint on the crowds, as I recall. And then there was also this ban on masks, or attempted ban on masks, so that people couldn't be identified by cameras. I mean, is that something that you're concerned about as a journalist? Like, do you get the sense of being surveilled while you're working?
It's certainly something you have to be cautious of. When I was inside of PolyU for about 5 days, and there were reports of undercover police around, which is one of those things that's quite difficult to confirm. But there's also, even at polling stations, there's been there've been suspicions as well that there have been undercover police deployed as quote unquote journalists, to be wearing press vests and using a camera on a monopod and sort of tilting it around. But, unlike journalists would be getting different angles, would be sort of looking for maybe the artsy shot, whereas these documented instances, it's sort of just these panning shots trying to take in as many faces as possible. And so, in that sort of situation, and definitely there were also earlier on in the movement during the summer, there were, instances where protesters tore down these, these towers that were intended to be sort of surveilled the population. And, as we've seen in Xinjiang and elsewhere in mainland China, the use of facial recognition technology is becoming increasingly prevalent. So I think many of those fears are quite founded.
Well, Bing, if I could stay with you for a moment, how has this affected ordinary people's interactions with the police, not during protests, but just in regular life?
What's pretty remarkable is that, the Hong Kong police were previously esteemed as, the best in Asia. They enjoyed widespread support and respect. And that's really no longer the case. In a matter of 6 months, they've managed to destroy several decades worth spent building goodwill. Very often, if there's any sort of substantial group of even, not even just protesters, but bystanders, you see a number of police vans going down through in Kowloon or Hong Kong Island, very often the police are met with jeers or obscenities, insults. Again, those are coming from all segments of society. You've got kids yelling at them, and you've got the very elderly yelling at them, and everybody in between.
Well, Jennifer Creary, our time grows short, but I wanted to give you the last word. Hong Kong does have legislative elections coming up in 2020. What do you foresee happening? Are you optimistic for the future?
Well, if the district council elections are anything to go by, many of the pro-democracy activists and pro-democracy groups are hoping for that to be replicated, the wide turnout and the pro-Beijing wipeout. If you will, of candidates, bearing in mind the district council elections are historically won by pro-Beijing candidates. And so certainly protesters are hoping to replicate that. Currently in LegCo, there's a small group of pan-democrats who have very little power. Having said that, they do stage demonstrations within the Legislative Council, which is the city's parliament, if you will. So many activists are hoping to channel their activism through that route and hopefully replicate the district council elections.
Well, that's all we've got for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Bing Guan, Jennifer Creary, and Stephen Russolillo for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Samantha Wiegand and Charles Tranguinness. Trevor Hook is our supervising producer. Kyle McCubbin is visual editor. Tia Thomas is audio engineer. Kathy Kiley is executive editor. And Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.